Hello, this is Barbara Steele on the line. Is there anyone in the room that can speak to the Adobe Connect?
Hi, Barbara. This is Marika. The link for the Adobe Connect is on the schedule. It's not the usual working group room.
Right, and I clicked on it, and it's telling me connecting, but I had problems with it yesterday as well for another meeting.
Yeah, you might need to restart or try a different browser. That sometimes helps as well.
Okay, I'll do that. Thanks.
We have some other meetings that are finishing now.
Will we just be looking at the presentation?
Yes, correct.
Okay, all right.
And we'll be talking to you. We just have some people entering the room now, so we just give it a few minutes as some other meetings are finishing now, so we'll get started shortly, okay?
No problem. I'll be muting you for the
Thanks.
Intro.
Is there live video on the Adobe Connect today?
Hi, George. No, this meeting is taking place in a small room, so there's no video. That's only for the big hall.
Okay.
Hi there, Marika. This is the operator speaking.
Hello. I'm here.
Hi there. Are you able to hear me?
Yes. Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Hello there. Sorry, just to confirm, will you let me know when to start the recording?
Yes, I will.
Perfect. Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Maybe I can invite those sitting in the back of the room just to come to the table, as this is intended to be an interactive discussion, and as there's plenty of room around the table, you're more than welcome to come here.
Hi, Marika. It's Anil George on the Adobe Connect. It says the host has not arrived yet.
You need to use Adobe Connect that's in the meeting schedule. It's not the usual Adobe Connect room. So if you go to the meeting schedule and find this meeting, you'll see in there the link to this room.
Okay.
Hey, Marika. I'm actually trying to use it, and I'm still running into the same problem I had yesterday, even using a different browser. So if you can just let us know when you change slides, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
George here. You may want to upgrade your Adobe Flash because it uses Flash.
Okay, I'll give that a try.
Operator, can you please get the recording started and let me know as soon as it has?
Thank you. One moment, please.
Thanks.
The call is now recorded. Please go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the wonderfully exciting world of IRTP. My name is Michaela Nalan, and I'm the chair of this working group. I suppose, should we do a roll call, Marika? Or?
Yes.
Okay. I think probably the simplest thing, if we just go around the table quickly, and if everybody would just identify themselves quickly, and I'll start. I'm Michaela Nalan from Black Knight.
Chris Chaplow from the Business Constituency.
Barry Cobb, Business Constituency.
Marika Konings, ICANN Staff.
Jonathan Stanton from MCD.
Carlo Taldomini for Sweden.
David Giza, ICANN Contractual Compliance.
Paul Diaz, Network Solutions.
Mikey O'Connor, Business Constituency.
James Bladel, GoDaddy.
Rob Hall, Momentus.
Pinsey from Thailand.
Roman Marx, .ru Luxembourg.
Karen Vink, SIDN.
Sebastian Assink, Auxilion, Dutch Register.
Wiebren Braakman, Rietam Register. Paul van Brouwshaven, Networking for All.
Okay, perfect.
People on the line.
And okay, could you?
And I think we have Barbara Steele, George Kirokos, and Anil George. Is there anyone else on the phone bridge?
George Kirokos, can you make sure everybody talks loudly into the mic, please? Because we can't hear everybody.
Okay, we'll remind everyone to please speak into the microphones.
Okay then. We'll start. We have an initial report which we have prepared, and we're just going to go through this. And if there's anybody who has any questions, if something isn't clear, or if you are already overly familiar with the subject matter and you're finding it terribly boring, please let us know. So I don't want you to sit through a bunch of slides when you could probably just download them yourselves. Because I think that's a bit pointless. The inter-registrar transfer policy is basically the bit about how you transfer a domain between two ICANN accredited registrars. This PDP working group is the second in a series which is aimed at making improvements and clarifying various parts of the policy so that everything works much better for all parties concerned. Next slide, please. Now, as in common with other PDPs, we were asked to address certain specific questions. In other words, we are not being asked to change the entire process or anything like that. We're being asked to look at certain aspects of the process, certain aspects of the policy. So the questions we were asked to address were to do primarily with inappropriate transfers and hijacks of registrations, registrar lock statuses. Just bear me a second. Registrar lock statuses, and what else? Bear me one second. Yes. So the PDP started back in June of 2009. It's now been running for the thick end of a year. During the course over that time, we have been discussing the charter. We've had a public comment period. We've collected some input from various parts of the community, including other stakeholder groups. We've had extensive input from ICANN's compliance team. And the reason why that would have happened is because ICANN's compliance team would be those who deal with complaints from the public in relation to ICANN accredited registrars and that entire system. So that was one area we got a lot of good, useful information. And then we published our initial report prior to this ICANN meeting, and we will be opening a comment period after the meeting. We're expecting to be able to open the comment period to the public on the 5th of July. So after this, if you have the time to read over the report, if you haven't done so already, and to give us your input using the online public comment forum. So what have we come up with so far? Well, certain things are pretty obvious. We recognise that there is a need to have a process for the urgent return of a domain name. Now, what we're talking about here is not something like dealing with buyer remorse or seller remorse or sorting out any problems between two parties who have agreed to something and then one party decides, oh no, I sold that domain for far too low a price. What we're talking about here is the situation where I have a domain name which I'm using and I'm very happy to have, and somebody somehow manages to capture that domain name and I lose control of it. And once this happens, then in simple terms, bad things could happen. Under the current system, there is an informal communication type scenario between various registrars and VeriSign and the other registries. But from what we have been able to gather, this is not sufficient. And I think some of the other members of the working group might be able to speak to that. So what we have put in place initially, and this again I cannot stress enough, that this is an initial report. This is, we're not pretending or trying to tell anybody that this report or any of the other suggestions within this are final. They are being put together to get feedback from people. We don't want a situation to arise that any improvements that we suggest would have a more negative impact than the evil that we are trying to combat. So it is crucial that people who feel that there is something wrong or that there is better ways of doing this, let us know in a constructive manner. So the working group and several members of came together and put together what we are now calling the Expedited Transfer Reverse Policy, which is now ETRP and is now part of the ever-growing ICANN glossary. So ETRP is an escalation process, preferred option for resolving dispute. It's an escalation process. The preferred option would be to resolve the dispute between the two registrars. This is for the scenario where the losing registrar cannot find contact or engage with the other registrar who's ended up with the domain name. And the main elements that we put together in this, next slide please, Marika. That is be a mandatory policy. The registrant claiming to be a victim of a hijacking would need to work with their original registrar, in other words, the registrar where the domain was before it was hijacked. The original registrar must in principle initiate the procedure within 60 days. The registrant needs to provide indemnification to the original registrar and to the registry operator. In other words, if you as the aggrieved party wish to take advantage of this proposed policy, you must indemnify the registrar and the registry, so that you can't just use this, as I already said, as a kind of a cop-out because you made a bad decision. Go ahead, Rob.
Sorry, quick question. You used the word registrant there.
Yes.
Is that really what you intend? Like, he may not be the current registrant. You really mean the former customer.
What we...
Clarification. Maybe I'm out of the loop. But
No. It's a very valid question. One of the problems we've actually had is actually dealing with the terminology. Because could you identify yourself, please, Rob?
I'm Rob Hall.
Okay, Rob Hall. This is for the transcript.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rob Hall of Momentus.
One of the problems we have in this scenario is that you have is somebody who registered a domain, who we normally would call a registrant, that may have changed. Then we end up where there's the new registrants. If you read the full report, there's an entire section within us with various terms that we've tried to define as best we could.
I'm assuming what you mean is the client of the original registrar.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
exactly. Yeah, sorry. I'd refer to the aggrieved party because, we did say registrant, and thank you for pointing that out.
Just a question. There's some people online that have questions as well. Do you want to wait until after each charter question? You want to take questions at the end, in between? What do you prefer?
We might as well just do it as we go. It's probably easier.
Okay. George has a question.
Sure. Go ahead, George.
Can you go back to the very first charter question, please? If you could scroll back on the slide, that would help. One of the things was first slide. Urgent return of a domain name. How do you define what is urgent? You know, somebody could have a $1,000 domain name that isn't of very much value. This whole work group started when there was, you know, a major New York ISP that was hijacked, and it disrupted, you know, tens of thousands of customers due to that hijacking. How do you contrast between an urgent return versus just a desire to return a domain name? Also, aren't there other procedures already in place? People can go to court, for example, for an injunction, just like Microsoft did to take down, you know, that botnet. Why do people feel that this needs to be a mandatory process, that ICANN needs to have a process in place for, you know, every remote possibility, when even the report itself says that only 3% of complaints involve hijacking, and that was 10th in the number of in the ranking of complaints, whereas more major issues were people wanting EPP codes and things like that. So,
okay, George.
Those are my initial questions.
Okay, perfect. James?
Hi, and to address the question, what we defined as urgent, to explore that particular definition, which we did spend some time on, we undertook some discussions relative to the existing mechanism, which is the Transfer Dispute Resolution Policy, the TDRP. And after examining the experiences that various registries and registrars had with the timeliness of that program, we understood that to be not urgent and not a very effective mechanism to address these particular cases where a name has been hijacked and the harm is occurring on an hourly or daily basis, and that process can take weeks or months. But
The TDRP as currently drafted doesn't distinguish between the types of domains and doesn't qualify the complaints by any sense of urgency.
Is George,
that something that would go into a final report that would qualify it very precisely as to what's urgent? And also, if you can go into my prior question about why isn't our court injunctions better? Like, why does everybody need to use the TDRP? Why can't people just go to the court just like Microsoft did if it's a true emergency and get it done that way, where there is, you know, due process and so on?
Okay, George, in terms, this is an interim report. It's going to be open.
All right, I know. This is my input.
No, I know that. The thing is that the points that you raise are valid questions. To deal with the one, for example, with respect to getting court injunctions, while it might be relatively easy in some jurisdictions and it might not be cost prohibitive to get an injunction quickly if you're a Microsoft or an Amazon or a Google or, you know, some other large multinational corporation with hundreds of staff at your beck and call, the rest of us unfortunately don't have that.
However, you said that the problem was for urgent returns. Urgent implies that there's damages that are immediate and ongoing and can't be repaired simply by, you know, paying money, that, you know, the damages are enormous. If the damages aren't urgent, you don't need this process, in other words, correct?
This is Barbara. I just wanted to add that this particular process is not intended to preclude an injured party, if you will, from pursuing any other options available to them, but it's an additional option that's available in the event that they don't have a lot of money to go to court and pay to have it to go that route.
Right. The thing is, the if the damages are small, then it's not an urgent return, and people can go through the normal course. Because we haven't talked about what the collateral damage of this policy is, as stated. The collateral damage is much bigger. You need to narrow the scope of this proposed procedure, if it's even going to be adopted, to narrow it to those that are true emergencies, not just, you know, to any person that wants to, you know, back out of a domain deal, even though you said that the policy wasn't intended for that.
Okay.
As it's currently written, it can definitely be used for that.
George, if we can just respond, I think the urgent is at least that's not understood it in the discussion of the group, is not related to whether it's urgent because people are losing money. It's whether it's urgent because the domain name has been hijacked. And I think the intention was how to have a process for really clear-cut cases. This is not to dispute any kind of other measures, but really clear-cut cases. And that's what the group is trying to come up with a policy for. And this is the reason as well why this is an initial report to look at what questions or what kind of gaps might be in the proposal. But I think that's the objective. And I think we probably should discuss this further as well in the working group in the second phase. And just to clarify as well, this is not a question the working group has come up with. This question was put forward as part of an extensive review that was conducted by the council on the review of the IRTP. And this was one of the questions that was raised as part of that process in which, community input was received and discussed, amongst other, as a result of an ESSEC report that looked into this issue. And that's how the question ended up with the working group to look into further detail into these questions.
Mark, I know that.
Sorry,
George, fiber squatting.
George, can you just wait for Michaela to give you the word, please? George, can you please just wait for Michaela to give the word to people that are in the queue here in the room as well?
Okay, George. With all due respect, this is a public meeting, and that means that it's a time for us to be able to take input from more than one person. So I have other people in the room and other people online who want to put forward their opinions and give their views. So I have to give them a chance to do so. I'll take Rob.
I'll jump in the back of the queue and wait for the next opportunity.
Okay, thank you. And I think we have Anil George as well. So if you go Rob and then Anil.
Correct. I just wanted to make a comment.
Wait, Anil. Wait a second.
I'm going to let him go.
Go ahead.
Hello? Go ahead, Anil.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment to what was discussed. I think by definition, when you have a situation where a transfer is in the context of a hijacking, I think that by itself is an urgent situation. I think we should not get sidetracked into a debate about what is urgent and what is not urgent. I don't think the goal of this group was to preclude any legal opportunities that parties may have, but it is to provide an additional method, something that is quite frankly cost-effective. As an attorney for a corporation, they have an urgent situation, but it doesn't mean that we necessarily want to throw lots of money into a court case when there is a more efficient and reliable manner that will allow you to that you can access.
Hi, it's Rob Hall. I want to take a step back from this, and I apologize for these are probably my first comments to this group, and they shouldn't have been. It seems to me it's not a matter of defining urgency or not. I want an instant return. So my client comes to me as a registrar and says, this has been stolen from me. It seems to me that in order to facilitate more transfers and open up how easy it should be to transfer, we need to have an undo command. And that should be instant and effective and start a different process at that point. So my client comes to me, says, that was mine, it was in my account yesterday, it's gone today, give it back. It's not about how much damage is being done by the hour or how much web traffic he gets. It's about a change was made that we need to reverse. And we need to reverse it instantly. It should be on my honor as a registrar, my contract, that I can undo that. Now, that should start something in place that says, okay, now we've got a dispute, we need to figure it out. But the first thing in ironing out that dispute is undo the change that was made. Let's not forget this is a change that was made. So a simple undo mechanism to say, and instant, it ought to be an EPP command that says, give that back, and it comes back to me. Now maybe as a registrar, I contractually have to restore it to what it was, keep it what it is, lock it in some way, until the two registrars work out what's going on. But let's have a way for our customers to say, someone did something, a change was made, undo it, and then let's figure it out. So the figure it out process is important to be mandatory, but it's got to be instant. We can't be talking about going to court and in what country and in what jurisdiction and the one of the registry. My clients are in Canada, not where VeriSign is for a com or where DE is for a .de or in Germany. So I want to always keep in mind what we're trying to accomplish here, because if we can figure out how to allow transfers to be undone quickly when there's a mistake made or malicious conduct, we can all then figure out how to change the transfer process to allow it to be much easier. I can go to my bank and wire $1 million to ICANN, and I hate doing it, but it's easy. If that was done fraudulently, the banks would immediately cooperate, reverse the money, and then figure it out. That's what it should be like with assets in a domain name.
Thank you. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, my view would be that we don't actually need to define urgency because in my company, for instance, I've got various websites. Some of them are very important to me, others aren't such important. So it could be that if a domain was hijacked and it wasn't a valuable one and there was no damage being done, then I would decide it's not urgent and just use the TDRP or just speak to the registrars. Thank you.
Mikey?
This is Mikey O'Connor. I just want to follow on behind Rob's comment. I mean, the fundamental notion that we had when we designed this process was quick return and then a thoughtful process to resolve the dispute, give the, you know, set the situation back to the way it was, and then give the players time and appropriate venues and all sorts of options to get the dispute resolved. And so I think Rob said it just right, but I think the second half is equally important, the dispute resolution process that follows, you know, leveraging the processes that are already in place between registrars, with the TDRP as sort of the last possible layer of process if there's nothing else that can happen.
All right, thank you. Is there anybody else in the queue there? I believe George was in the queue. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, I'd like to give Rob the scenario. Okay, look, first, it's not an instant return. Well, it's an instant return, but you have 6 months to ask for it. That's kind of a joke. Let me give Rob the scenario. Let's say I buy a domain name from somebody whose domain is at OnlineNIC or RegisterFly or DirectNIC, which is located in the Cayman Islands, and I transfer it during the buying process to Momentus. Now, 3 months later, the guy gets cold feet, and instantly the domain name is returned to the Cayman Islands or to the Chinese registrar. The domain name, you know, with no notice, there's no possibility of dispute, is just grabbed back, and they already have the money. Are you going to actually, you know, how do you protect me as a customer from that scenario? And, you know, when you're doing a purchase, and the secondary market is obviously much bigger than the primary market, you want the transfer to be irrevocable, and you use the wiring of cash as an example. That's a perfect example, because how would pool.com work if people's payments were not irrevocable? You know, let's say I wire, you know, $1 million to buy a certain domain name from Pool. I transfer the domain name away from me, and 5 months later, I undo the wire transfer. Imagine what would happen to the payments
George, let me start answering your questions one at a time if I can. So I'll deal with the last one first. We deal in an environment where I assure you up to 18 months later someone can cancel their credit card for the purchase they made for us. We deal with this every day. Consumers always win when they go to the banks. The banks cooperate with them and give their money back. So there is no surety in wiring or credit card of money. The banks, if one bank goes to another and says there was a fraud or something happened that shouldn't have, they undo it. They trust each other.
Not the wires. The wires are irrevocable.
Well, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So a bank that says we wired this money to you incorrectly, it was fraudulent, it will be undone instantly. Okay.
Yeah, but they won't
so stop. Wait. Stop, George. I'm going to answer your first question, and I'm just going to keep talking. If that's
okay. Kind of,
okay. So I think your first question was, how would I feel about, you know, the transfer? You're talking about two transfers here. You're talking about
exactly.
A change of
you're not perverse,
George. Stop, George. I'm going to keep talking.
You're talking about two transfers here. That one person is better than the other.
Okay. As the chair, I'm going to put you on mute, George. George, I'm putting you on mute.
Operator, can you please put the line of George Kirikos on mute for now, and we'll tell you when you can unmute it, please.
That's possible. Cool. Sorry, I got to use that service for our meetings. You're talking about two transfers, and as harsh as it may be, you're talking about the transfer or change of registrant, which is a contract you would have signed with the gentleman you bought it from, who could be anywhere, but the registrar is in the Cayman Islands. And the second thing you're talking about is you've chosen to change registrar. Those are two different things. All right? So if the person that sold you the domain wants to screw you, I would hope that your contract is good enough with him that you can get damages out of him and do something with him. That has nothing to do with the choice of registrar you host your domain at or sponsors your domain. So let's not confuse the issue about the fact that a change in registrant when you're buying and selling domains is a very different thing than changing registrars. I also think the process should be, yes, an immediate return. I mean, granted, I think 6 months is probably, you know, too long, but I don't want to get into that debate. Most of these things are going to happen within days. I mean, we're responsible for GC.ca, the Government of Canada domain. If it went down for an hour, we wouldn't wait 6 months. I mean, we need it back within minutes. It's not a question of how long can we wait or how much damage is being done. There's damage being done, even if it's little Joe's plumbing shop. So the question becomes then, if I do that incorrectly as a registrar, I ought to get whacked and whacked hard. Okay, I talked earlier about my honor as a registrar, my conduct as a registrar. This process ought to say if the Cayman Island guy gets it back without doing his due diligence and transfers it back fraudulently, he should get whacked. And that's not to say that that's nothing to do with the original registrant or the buyer or seller. We're not going to get involved in you buying a domain from a third party and your escrows and your money transfers and everything else. That's not a registrar's job. My job as a registrar is to make sure that the transfer happened legally and to undo it if it didn't. That's my job. And it should be limited to that. And I know we get into all these other debates, but it's about undoing a wrong. And yeah, 6 months is probably too long or fine. Most of these are going to happen in days. You know, I shudder a bit when I see the you know, it's 60 days or 6 months. I'd rather just see it's this, so we know. But that's the challenge we face, is we have to be able to undo these, because with that comes the freedom to move. We can make it much easier for someone to move.
Thank you, Rob. If George would like to respond.
You might. Sure. Rob spoke about undoing, a crime being occurred. What's the proof? You're just saying that my request to have the domain name back is the proof. That's not any proof at all.
Sorry, George, it is. My original client has come to me and say this domain transferred illegally.
Go ahead.
This domain transferred without my permission. Get it back. If he's wrong in making that statement to me, then you've got damages against him. Go talk to him. This is between two private parties. If I'd gone to him as a registrar and he said, yes, I approve this transfer, yes, let the transfer go, and then I as a registrar just, you know, okay, grab it back, you know, improperly or fraudulently, I should have a problem as a registrar.
I'll take Mikey and then this gentleman down on my right whose name tag I can't read.
Oh, this is Mikey. Rob said what I was going to say.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Sebastian Essing from Auxilion. Just want to respond to one thing you said. You said that if a customer, your customer says to you that a change of registrant or change of registrar has been made illegally, then that's your proof. Well, that might be for them, some part of this country. Sorry, for some parts of this world, but that's not for the whole world. So you're going to have to deal with the legal thing that's what in your country. So there's a difference between countries, for sure.
I agree, and as a registrar, if I'm asking for it back, I should be aware of what I'm doing and be up to the consequences of that. So I better be damn sure my client's right.
Yeah, but right? So how are you going to be so damn sure?
That's my job as a registrar. He's my client.
Okay, I'll take Paul Diaz.
Yes, Paul Diaz for Network Solutions. I think that point that Rob just made is what's missing, and your point as well, that by bringing it back to the original registrar, you have a party now that is going to lock the name down and let the party sort it out. The reason this is focused on hijackings, of course, is because so often names, when they get hijacked, move to a registrar that is not going to be compliant, not going to work with the parties to try and sort it out. So let's also always remember that the whole point of this to bring it back to the original registrar, because they are the ones who are going to act in good faith to help sort it out.
Okay, thank you. I mean, the point is well made about the legal thing as well. This was one of the things that we were trying to do within this process. We had the idea that of the indemnification, but obviously the exact fine details of this.
Well, it's an important one. The only person in this whole chain that knows the registrant and has a relationship with them is the original registrar. The new one doesn't. The new one may have a relationship with someone he thinks is, but he doesn't. The only entity that has a relationship and knows their client is the original registrar. So I completely agree. Undo it and then figure it out. The process to figure it out has to be mandatory. You can't just undo it and sit on it. It should start a bigger discussion. But undo it instantly get it back, get it working, and then you've got time to go to court. Then you've got time to figure it out, let the parties dispute it, do whatever you want. At least you know where it is.
Mikey?
Rob just got on to another point, which is what's the scope of this particular process? This process is, does not have dispute resolution within its scope. This is simply the return process, and then all the dispute resolution stuff surrounds it. And that's another important facet to keep in mind.
Okay, I'll take Rob Golding and then the lady sitting. Joyce. Rob,
hi,
go ahead.
Rob Golding, Othello Technology Systems. Whilst I understand the concept of the immediate return, not every registrar knows their customers as well as the guy over there. We deal a lot with registrants who have domains stuck with what we would term degenerate registrars, who either don't let them go, don't give them the EPP codes, deliberately lie in the transfer emails, and we work very hard with those registrants to get their domains away from people. I am quite reticent at signing anything that would allow the naughty registrar involved in that process to just be able to grab it back and sit on it while some process, which might not even be necessary, is started to determine the owner and the legality of the transfer.
Rob, have you been introduced to David Geezer? I think if you're having those kind of problems, and as a registrar, as a registrar, I know all about them. I think you need to really talk to David and his team. Joyce, and then Matt.
I'm Joyce Lim from 007 Names. I think that the registrar, like getting their domain name back before, when he gets the request to get the name back, I think the registrar really needs to do a very good work in checking everything about this person, and it's like a lawyer to do diligence. Sorry, another day. That's just my opinion that both parties has to do a good job. And then I have a question about once the domain name or domain names been returned to the original registrars, how about the transfer fees that the registrars already charged the registrar? Would that be reversed too?
I think we discussed that. I think there was this thing with the fee. I think Barbara and several of us were discussing this, that there is this, the idea that the cost would actually cover that. So it would be, I think it was reversed, wasn't it? I can't remember the exact way we had that worked out.
Why? Sorry, who cares?
Well, no, it's to the...
Because... The other registrar was charged for the transfer.
I get it. And so now we're in a dispute where you say you're allowed to have this, I'm not allowed to have this. We're spending far more money than the $6 or $7 for the domain name arguing amongst ourselves. The registrant ultimately has gotten an extra year, so he's happy. I mean, really, we're arguing about whether that should be undone for what... If I win and I get the domain back, you're out $7 because you fraudulently transfer domain. If you win, you get the domain back, and I'm out, you know, a lot more.
Well, if we're talking about what you're mentioning, which is an undo of a command, an undo of a transaction, then we've got to undo the entire thing, and that's
fair,
the
fair
fee
enough.
And the year extension. Yeah. Both of those would come back. So,
fair enough. All right.
I mean, it's just another way of looking at it, but okay. We discussed this pretty extensively.
I have one more comment. I don't think that the urgency should be the name there. I think that everybody's domain names is important to this registrant, regardless how valuable the domain name is. We should treat every domain name, every registrant equally.
Well, this was something, it's a very valid point. A lot of this stuff, when we started looking at the various reports that came before this PDP started, they were all talking about high-value domain names. And personally, I would value my own personal domain name a lot to be, you know, it's something that I have a hold of value to, and I'm sure a lot of people sitting around this table in this room may not be running multi-million corporations but still put a lot of value in a personal domain name. It doesn't have to be that. I mean, it should be, since everybody needs to have their protections, I don't disagree with that at all. Matt and then Rob.
Thanks, Michele. Matt Serlin. So I just wanted to pick up on, I believe his name was what Rob had said, and just remember that the goal of this is very specific incidents of domain names being fraudulently hijacked, transferred, whatever. So, you know, Michele's point was right. If you've got a registrar where getting an auth code is an issue and, you know, you get the name transferred and then they use this process to transfer it back, that's very clearly a compliance issue. So I don't want to get, caught up in instances like that. Let's, I think Rob Hall's point earlier, stay focused on these very specific incidents of hijacking.
Go ahead, Rob.
I completely agree. This is not about the fringe and the, oh, my God, we've got a registrar who does that. I think the barrier to transferring back should be high enough that it starts a process that might be costly enough that registrars only do it when they're pretty sure. So I can give you an example of my good friend at GoDaddy here and I. Our two registrars got into a transfer dispute. It actually went to appeal, and the appellant assessed the loser over $3,000. This isn't cheap for any of us. I mean, the time we spent... But if you're wrong here, so if I transfer one back and I'm found to have done it fraudulently or with malice or anything else, whack me, and whack me hard. I mean, that we've got to stop that from happening. But so I'm going to be pretty sure I want this back before I do it. So I don't mind high barriers, hopefully not in cost, but in longer term cost if I'm wrong. But it's all about that procedure and what starts. It's not about getting the domain working in its original state again.
James, you had your hand up, I think.
Yeah, just briefly, and I think the gentleman over here was discussing how to get it out of that. If he's working with the registrant, the legitimate registrant in that particular situation, the losing registrar, I believe this process does call for some identification or verification mechanism. So they would, in effect, they would have a bigger problem in that they would be falsifying that documentation as well. And secondly, I think I want to just bring it kind of back to the overview, which is that, we're trying to address a problem. We recognize with this proposal that it doesn't fully address the problem, that it maybe is an 80-20 approach. It addresses 80% of the problem and still leaves this margin. And then we're talking about the fringe of that fringe, and we're talking, when we talk about some of the scenarios. So we need to focus on the balancing of proportional harms. A lot of folks are victimized by hijacking. It is probably much more prevalent than some of these other scenarios that, while plausible, are possibly a lot less likely and a lot less likely to affect people who don't engage in a lot of, advanced domain name activities, but more focused on the use and the development of a business or a personal website. So I just wanted to bring that back to an overview that we're really trying to focus on protecting those folks.
Okay, thank you, James. George, I believe you're in the queue.
Thanks. Rob spoke about how the old registrar knows their client. Here's the scenario. The old registrar, who knew his client, approved the outgoing transfer. So what's the story that somehow, after the fact, the registrar is claiming that they don't know their client? If the registrar is in a position where they know their client, the registrar can opt in their client to high security, for example. There is VeriSign's domain lock approved by ICANN, although they didn't put any pricing caps or protections for consumers. But that product exists. You can lock down a domain name. Google.com is protected through Mark Monitor. Facebook, you're not going to be able to steal these domains unless there's human intervention at the registrar and at the registry. So these domains are protected. Now, if registrars truly know who their clients are, they can. They're in the position as the losing registrar to notify their client when there's an outgoing transfer, when there's a registrant change at the existing registrar. So these registrars who claim to know their client are in the position to do all the pre-verification to make sure that it's what they really want to have the outgoing transfer, and in particular. To initiate this process of the ETRP, the policy says that the losing registrar has to, verify that it's a valid request and this identification of the registrant, their client. It begs the question:
why did they not do this before approving the transfer to the new registrar? Answer me that.
Rob, would you? Before you go ahead, Rob, one thing, George, is I think you're being a small bit contradictory. You say, if you let me continue, if you said in your previous intervention that you were asking why we would want to have any kind of process for this, couldn't we all just go to court? And yet, when you then go on to cite domain names that belong to multi-million corporations. And also another thing, just a factual point for you. While VeriSign has introduced the registry lock, and I believe Neustar have also introduced it in the last couple of weeks for .biz, it is not available on all domain extensions. It is not available through all registrars. And the ESSAC reports and other community input that drove the instigation of this working group raised many issues about how domains could be kidnapped. And I mean, I can give you cite one example that happened within a CCTLD, just because I know it happened, where a large corporation transferred a domain from one registrar to another, and it was valid and it was authorized, but then it turns out that somebody else in a different department of the company lost their head completely because they wanted to have all the domains with the same registrar. And they were able to reverse it, but it doesn't. There's multitude of ways in these there are a multitude of ways that these things can happen, and not all of them are going to be foolproof. Rob, please go ahead.
George, I'll give you the answer to your specific scenario, and then I'll give you a broader one. So the specific scenario is we've got 5 days to get out to our customer and ask them to say no. If we don't hear from them in those 5 days, the domain transfer happens because we're not allowed to hold it up for non-response from a customer. Customer's on vacation for a week, comes back, says, "Where the hell's my domain? My email stopped halfway through my vacation." We're past the 5 days. We need to instantly undo that. So that'll solve your scenario of why do we not catch them all? Why are we not able in our sorry.
After you're done.
So I want to get, and this is going to probably upset some of my registrar compatriots here. I have a bit of a different view of how the world should be in transfers. So I go to one of there shouldn't be locks. We have these things called EPP codes. They're like PIN numbers. You have that, you should be able to move it. If we have an effective undo command that immediately starts a dispute resolution process, we can lower the barrier on how easy it is for consumers. Because right now it's pretty damn tough for consumers to transfer their names from one registrar to another in a lot of cases. Registrars make it tough. I mean, the last thing you want to do is lose a client. So to undo that and to allow consumers the benefit of transferring easily between registrars, we need to do it as simple as possible. I think an EPP auth code that's valid should overrule any lock. I can transfer money with my password on my bank around the world. Why? Because they can undo it. Because it's traceable, it's trackable, and there's a way to rectify it if something goes wrong. That's the key here, is auditing and the ability to undo. And then we can lower the barrier and let people move between registrars easier, so the gentleman here doesn't have the problem of, a registrar really wants to move and can't. That should never happen. A registrar wants to change registrars, they should be able to do it. It should be within their power to do it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Can I respond to that?
Actually, no. Because what I'm going to, I need to move through the rest of this report, and then everybody can then give input at the end, because otherwise we're not going to get through this and we're a bit stuck for time. just going into some of the details, anyway, we have this proposed reverse policy. Sorry, my throat is a bit gone. The various elements of this are contained within the initial report. And we, as I already said, we will be opening a comment period on this. And this would be the perfect time if people have input and suggestions and comments to give that in as much detail as they wish. And if people are interested in joining this working group, please let us know, because the more input we have, the better it will be. Okay, just going back to this overview. The ETRP is only intended to correct fraudulent transfers, not to resolve disputes in relation to control. The working group agrees that there should be a mechanism to dispute an ETRP, but has not reached agreement yet on how such a mechanism should work. The thing is, it's not meant to act as anything more than what it's meant to do. I mean, it's meant to just do what it says on the tin. Why are those slides different to the ones I have in front of me? Never mind. Okay, moving on. There were other questions with it that this working group were looking at, not just rapid returns. One of the other areas looking at Charter 2, question 2, we were talking quite a bit about who is, and requested an issues report on the requirement of thick who is for all GTLDs. A thick registry could develop a secure method for gaining registrar to gain access to the registrant contact information, avoiding disputes between registrant and admin contact. And a bit of clarification, that, which we discussed at length as well, only the registrant can effect a change of control, while both the registrant and admin contact remain eligible to authorise a transfer that does not modify any contact information. What else do we have? And the other one, then the charter question 3. Next slide, please, Marika. Change of registrar near change of registrant, or change of registrant near change of registrar. The working group recognised the symptoms of this question as one of several indicators, but considers there is no plausible outcome that would make any change effective for the purpose. And the basic problem we're battling with here is, you know, what do you do if the registrant details are changed, and then there is a transfer? Is that valid? Invalid? How do you determine this? And it's something I think we really hadn't reached any firm conclusions. We discussed it quite a bit, but don't think we got too far beyond that. Now, another area that we did get into some lengthy conversations, and I, as chair of the group, I'd like to thank the valuable input we received from VeriSign, was in relation to registrar lock statuses. One thing that we felt it would be very helpful for everybody would be if we were to be able to standardise and clarify who is status messages regarding registrar lock status. The goal of these changes is to clarify why the lock has been applied and how it can be changed. In simple terms, if somebody does a who is lookup on a domain and it comes back and it's locked, then you know it's locked, as opposed to it comes back and it's not showing it's not locked in who is, but then you discover that for some internal reason there is a lock on the domain and you can't transfer it. And we also noticed that if there is a review of the UDRP is conducted in the near future, the issue of requiring the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings should be taken into consideration. And then on to charter question. Where do I know this slide? Charter question 5. How to clarify denial reason number 7. So we propose some new language here. Prior to receipt of the transfer request, the domain name was locked pursuant to the registrar's published security policy or at the direction of the registered name holder, provided that the registrar includes in its registration agreement the terms and conditions upon which it locks domains, and further that the registrar provides a readily accessible and reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. And if somebody could help me break that up into a sentence that I could just read in one go without having to breathe 5 times, I'd appreciate it. If the registrar does not provide a means to allow a registered name holder to remove the lock status themselves, then registrar must facilitate removing the lock within 5 calendar days of receiving a request from the registered name holder. And the next... Yes, Rob, go ahead.
As your committee, and again, I apologize, I should have probably been part of it earlier, had discussions about getting rid of the lock status, like not having it. So remember this came from the old days.
Well, I wasn't around.
I'm dating myself, yes. It was my 34th ICANN meeting, damn it. And we've had these debates all along. But in the old days, you applied for a transfer just with no EPP code, with no auth code, with no authentication, and the only way to stop it was the 5-day period. So we introduced this concept of let's lock it so it can't get into that status. We now have EPP codes across the board. It is, in effect, a lock code, if you want to look at it that way. If you have that, it should override a lock, or we shouldn't have locks, one of those two. Because right now, there's no registry under ICANN that you can transfer a domain without having that code. So has your committee looked at shaking up the transfer process and getting rid of the legacy that doesn't apply anymore and going to a method of, that code is your lock code. Don't give it out if you don't want anyone to transfer to me.
Be perfectly frank, Rob, no, we haven't looked at that as an option.
Because it solves a lot of these things you're having huge debates about.
Well, this is why having you here in the room, okay, and getting your input is good. I mean, being perfectly honest with you, you know, we were working our way through a series of questions, and your suggestion, it's not invalid. There may be several people who will have wonderfully strong counter arguments to it, obviously,
sure,
just as I can. But it'll be good to hear them. Now I'll take. Okay, God, there's a queue of you. Mikey, Matt.
I can't see that.
Jonathan, and then I believe we have George on the line as well.
Thanks, Michele. This is Mikey. I think one of the problems, Rob, is that, you know, this particular PDP is like this death march. It's five chunks. It's been going on for 2 years. And what happened when we broke it into those chunks is that we made the scope decisions in a really narrow way. And so now what we've got is groups like this one that's working on a really narrow problem. And so we're sort of down one level of detail. And so when an idea like yours comes along, I'm being like a radio guy so that Michele can sort of catch his breath, because it's a breathtakingly cool idea. And I think what we would need to do is go back and take a look at our charter and sort of see where it fits in the scope of the charter and the list of the rest of the questions and all that stuff. But, you know, at least I, for one, would quite entertain the idea of taking a look at locks across the board, like you're saying, because, you know, it's different than the old days now by quite a lot. And, you know, we might want to, you know, Marika, you might want to kind of run this back up into the chartering cycle with Michele and see sort of what happens in terms of scope and all that stuff. But I, for one, would support it.
I'll be quick. This is Matt Serlin. And Mikey, thanks for the process piece of this. Rob, I'll address the issue of whether or not we should be looking at doing away with locks altogether. And I, for one, would come out vehemently against it, frankly. Because to me, while it may not be as necessary as it was when we didn't have auth info, I still think every additional layer of security that we can have in the DNS is a good thing. And I've worked very hard to get additional locks. So, you know, I worked really closely with VeriSign on registry lock. So the proposal to me to remove some of that is a little scary, actually.
Go on, Mikey.
No. I was just going to go with
Lynn. Go ahead.
Jonathan Stanton. If you do, if you're going to rely on having your PIN code and remove the waiver locks, you're going to need a secure and verifiable method of getting that key to the end user. And I wouldn't count just sending them as an email as a reliable method. If a disgruntled employee either hacks, walks into the company or walks out with their code, they could then transfer it.
You've just now given me, as a registrar, the ability to have a service that differentiates myself and makes me more competitive. So, yes, I agree. Registrars will come out with different ways. Maybe it's text only. Maybe it's email. Maybe it's secure. That, we're the competitive layer that should be thinking of those things. My only point is we had two transfer systems, old and new. We've now got one, which is EPP auth codes. We found a way to hack with this five-day thing and this locking. And I remember the old days, you know. My good friend Matt here, you know, 8 years ago it was Bruce who was sitting there as Network Solutions saying, no, we shouldn't even allow transfers. You know, anything to try and slow down transfers. So I expect the larger registrars that may lose clients to try and slow down transfers. But it would seem to me the purpose of the committee is to find a way to make them easier for consumers, not tougher. And putting more levels in the way of a customer saying, I just want to get away from the registrar I'm dealing with, and allowing the old registrar to prevent that and block that and lock it and stop it doesn't seem to me to be the way to move forward. We should be trying to find a way to move forward to say, hey, look, let's make this easy for consumers, and let's give them recourse to undo it.
I'll take George and then James.
Okay. First, somebody tried to make the point that VeriSign Lock isn't available at all registrars or registries. The fact is, registrars offer different levels of security. You can use Moniker Executive Lock, Fabulous as an Executive Lock. Consumers are able to pick the registrar that they feel most secure with. Note that to approve the transfer, you have to unlock the domain name. So that five-day period that Rob spoke about, it doesn't actually begin unless the domain name is unlocked. Furthermore, you need the EPP code, and that EPP code can be given by a secure method, for example, SMS codes. It can be sent by fax. It doesn't have to be done electronically. Matt spoke about adding multiple layers of security. I'm all for against that. If you look at my history, I've been arguing for that for 10 years. I bug two cows all the time about that. And sometimes they respond, sometimes they don't. And so I'm all for being proactive about improving the level of security for everyone. That being said, this policy does not do that. This proposed policy is reactive, not proactive. It's going to try to undo the transfers. But by making that loophole there, it's going to cause huge collateral damage in that people can misuse that for reverse hijacking. And so just to conclude, that EPP code, you know, do all the methods to prevent the release of that to an unauthorized person. You know, raise the level of security before the transfer. I'm, you know, 100% for that. But at some point, you have to say the domain name is in new hands. Otherwise, you can't just create this six-month period where the title ownership of the domain name is uncertain. Otherwise, you just, you know, totally destroy the secondary market. You know, you don't let people undo the transfer of the house for 6 months. At some point, there's a definitive date when that transfer is irrevocable. You know, at some point, I can't have to say, you know, we're no longer involved. Take it to the courts. Raise the security before the transfer? Fine. After the transfer, you better have a due process in place to make sure that, you know, people, if both sides dispute the transfer, you know, you got to retain the status quo. And that status quo is keeping it at the gaining registrar, not, you know, unprecedentedly moving it back. That just isn't done in any other ICANN policy.
Okay, thank you, George. James?
Yeah, just very briefly, Rob, I wanted to echo a little bit of what Mikey was saying in that, you know, we were kind of hemmed in quite a bit with this group. The strategic discussions about the transfer process, you know, kind of came in the past, and our ancestors handed us these five or six serial working groups that are very, very tightly scoped, probably because of so many of the controversies that were dealt with earlier. I like to think outside of the box with transfers. I like the idea of maybe even a dual key type of a transfer system, but you know, I felt like we were kind of constrained from going down some of those paths. I do have one quick response relative to getting rid of all locks, and that's in the UDRP. If you want, while a UDRP is in process, to make sure that people still have access to their name but can't move it, I think that might be one example.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Change the auth code to something only you know and don't give out. It's now effectively locked. So the auth code is a type of lock if we look at it that way, if only one person knows it.
Okay, but I just wanted to put out the idea that there are...
Okay, I've got plenty of people who want to get in the queue here.
Yeah, and I would like maybe after this we could, when my grandchildren have finished IRTP E or whatever the last one is, that we could all maybe sit down and talk about the lessons that were learned through this process, because I think there are creative ideas like the one Rob raised earlier that should be addressed. And if they can short-circuit this so we don't have to get to IRTP E, then we should look at that too.
All right, thank you. Marika, and then... let's see, I think Mikey, why not? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this is Marika, and you, even though I think the charter questions are narrowly defined based on the previous process where, you know, a group of people went through all these questions and looked at what, you know, was feasible or what was important or priority, I think nothing would prevent the working group if indeed they identify an issue saying, look, we have discussed this and we've identified an issue that we think might warrant further discussion or further investigation, to pass it back to the council. Probably, you know, if it's really not linked or a really broader question, it probably would require a new discussion by the GNSO Council and a decision on whether a new policy development process will be initiated, because it wouldn't fit with one of these questions. But I think it is important if the group identifies any areas where it feels that further research or further discussion is required, that information is, you know, captured in the report and not lost as just staying in this room here. So,
perfect. Thank you, Mikey, and then Chris. Okay, Mikey's bowed out. Chris.
Yes, it was just to remind us all that whatever lock or we use has got to be independent from the registrant's registrar account email address, because some of the examples we looked at the beginning were so dependent on that, weren't they? Once somebody got control of that email address, then there was so much that they could do. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else want to jump in? David, we haven't heard much from you today. You've been very quiet, so I think I'll just pick on you.
Thank you, Michele. And actually, I'm not going to add anything at this point and let others continue the dialogue.
That's perfect. Thank you. Go ahead, Rob.
I'd like to respond to that, gentleman. I disagree completely, sir. Sorry, I'm responding to you. I disagree completely. We should not be mandating what level a registrar has of security with his customers, whether it be email or fax. That's a differentiation between registrars. You should pick the one that does what you want. But this committee shouldn't be saying it can't be the email address, or we can't send off goods by email, or it shouldn't be related. Like that. That's up to the registrar. That's up to the consumer to choose the registrar that does what they want. So that's what differentiates us. Please don't try and make all registrars the same. We have to be different. We're the competitive layer. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I'm happy for you to be different, and I'm interested in myself in those extra services, but I don't think we as a group should be recommending the solution is that you've got to get extra additional services off the registrar. I was just reminding us, because there was talk about the authorization code through PINs and different systems or SMSs or whatever.
Well, so the auth code now is a PIN for all. I mean, I called it a PIN. It's a password. It's a PIN. I don't care what you call it. If the consumer has it, he can do what he, you know, the thing it's to be used for is to go to a new registrar.
Yeah, it can be anything as long as that you can't retrieve it by simply getting control of one email address.
If that's the model the registrar has chosen, if you as a consumer come to me and say, I want you to communicate with me through my email and only communicate through email and send everything through email, and then you say, give me my PIN, I'm going to send it to you. If you've had your email hacked by someone else or stolen, I should still send it to you. And I'm sorry, but you're now talking about a criminal act or fraud or something else that's beyond the scope of anything we deal with. If you as a consumer say, don't send it to my email, I don't think that's secure enough, only send it through text or when I log in using different authentication methods, those are all higher securities that registrars can offer. But I don't think we should ever be presupposing to say we shouldn't do something because it might have criminal activity involved if that's what the consumer is asking us to do, because it's too fringe.
Yes, well, it's an interesting debate, but from the cases we've looked at, this is where the weak link seems to be in the chain. Yep.
Okay, I believe George is in the queue.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that point by Rob saying, you know, once you give that EPP code, the consumer has a choice as to whether to pick a high security registrar or not and how to send their EPP code. That EPP code, once given, you know, that should be the final say. You can't just change your mind and say, oh, oops. And also, I'd like to talk about the point on criminality. Supposedly, these are all criminal events. Like, there were like 40 cases, I think, out of the 1,300 complaints to ICANN about hijacked domains. I didn't see in the report how many police reports were filed, how many of them actually ended up going back to the court. You know, we're talking about a very small number of claimed cases, yet we're opening up a loophole that can be used for much bigger damages. You know, this is the ability to undo a transfer for 6 months, unheard of. Also, I want to bring up a new topic, which was the topic of indemnity. This old registrant is supposed to indemnify the registrar, i.e. the losing registrar who's trying to regain the domain, and the registry. Am I wrong to assume, then, that the person who was reverse hijacked, let's say I transfer the domain to two cows, and somehow somebody reverse hijacks the name, you know, to get cold feet, or let's say Mark Monitor or one of the other big companies that does stealth domain acquisitions, you know, gets a domain name for Microsoft, say, you know, kin.com or docs.com, changes the name and then changes the ownership, and the person says, oops, I should have asked for $1 million, not $5,000. And so they pull the name back saying it was stolen. Can that indemnity actually work? Because
the person whose name is reverse hijacked is going to go and sue, you know, GoDaddy or VeriSign for undoing a legitimate transfer. Is that indemnity of somebody who sold their name for $5,000 that now wants $1 million, is that going to cover you for, you know, tens of millions of dollars of damages from a Microsoft whose name is, you know, reverse hijacked after, you know, 6 months of building up a huge website?
It's Rob again. I was a little surprised to see the indemnification requirement there, frankly, because registrars are pretty good at covering their asses and getting their clients to indemnify them and the registry. I think it's part of our registry contracts that we kind of have to indemnify the registry. I actually hate to see things there like indemnification that would prevent me from going after someone. So as a registrar, and if I'm going after registrar B, and I don't want to have my client indemnify them if they've really done something that he should be able to sue them for. So I don't know who he's indemnifying. If he's indemnifying me, I'll take care of that. You don't need to mandate it. I'll make sure I'm a, you know, if this guy's telling me something, I'm going to make sure I can go back at him if what he's telling me is not true. I mean, we do it in various cases. Indemnifying the registrar that may have done something wrong seems kind of early in the process because he may want the right to sue that registrar or that other registrant on the other end to get at who that registrant is. So I wouldn't want to see an indemnification of the registrar B in the process. Does that make sense? So
I don't think we were suggesting, Rob, I don't think we were suggesting indemnifying the registrar that had gained the domain.
Right. So you don't need to suggest to me that.
No.
I don't need indemnification. It's my client I'm talking to. I have that in my original contract. So, as will the registry. So I'm kind of surprised to see this as a topic, but
the reason this came in was that what we did not want to see happen was that, let's say I have a domain and I sell it to you,
yep,
for, let's say,
sure, okay,
€1,000.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly wake up and next day and realize that, oh my God, it was actually worth €100,000.
Yep.
And I'm now suffering from seller's remorse.
Right.
And I go to my original registrar.
Sorry.
Yes.
Domain hasn't moved registrars yet. Where does that come in play?
The domain has moved.
Okay, so wait. Original registrar transferred the domain to the new owner. Owner moved it.
Yes.
Old owner's got no say. Registrar at the time of move was the new owner. He's saying move it. Not a registrar's issue. Shouldn't be this committee's. It's between the two of them.
May I jump in?
Sure. Please go ahead.
Okay, Rob is talking about two different scenarios and how transfers takes place when there's a change of ownership. We can go into side discussion on whether there should be a separate mechanism for domain trade, which is what happened in the UK. But here are the two ways to do a domain sale. One way is that you do the transfer at the original registrar. So let's say somebody has example.com at GoDaddy. I can do the transfer at GoDaddy from the old registrant, I can, to me, and then transfer it to Two Cows. That's one way of doing it. However, if you do it that way, you're subject to, you know, every registrar having a different policy on what happens when there's a change of registrant. GoDaddy, for example, will lock a domain for 60 days. Other registrars have other ad hoc policies. And I consider that 60-day lock to be, you know, illegitimate, for example, because they're saying that it's an opt-in process, but, you know, I strongly disagree. And GoDaddy's been wrong before because they used to change do the lock on any Whois change, and now they're saying that people are actually opting into that. Now, the other method to do a sale, which is actually the best practice, and which is what actually GoDaddy recommends, is that when you do the transfer, you have the old registrant give the new registrant the EPP code. That registrant, you know, me, that new buyer or whatever, initiates the transfer, say, from Two Cows. The old registrant accepts it at GoDaddy. You know, they respond to all the emails, put in the EPP code, etc. And so the new ownership takes place directly from GoDaddy to Two Cows. So GoDaddy, the last Whois that they see is the old registrant. Two Cows, the first Whois that they see is the new registrant.
No,
that's actually
the preferred method
to do transfers. That's the way
no,
I always do it because
no,
it's irrevocable.
No,
but that,
George,
that's why
stop.
I caught up under this policy.
George, you're wrong. You're,
no,
you're absolutely wrong. The
I
first,
do millions of dollars
no, 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 no.
I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
Go ahead.
That's
why?
Practically what happens. That's not technically what happens. The first Whois Two Cows sees in your example, the new registrar, is the original registrant. They have a duty to see it. They have a duty to go and get it. They have a duty to communicate to that registrant and say, do you want to transfer your domain to TwoCows? What's happening in your case is just the opposite. It's transferring under the old registrant, and then you're changing at TwoCows who the registrant is. A domain registrant does not change during the transfer process, ever. And once you understand it gets much clearer. It just does not happen.
But under this undo policy, it would be caught up under that scenario.
George, this is not a matter of policy. This is a matter of protocols. EPP does not work that way. The way Rob has described it is the way it works, and then we have layers of policy on top of that.
And in fact, the policy says, as TwoCows transfer the domain, they must make sure the registrant wants to transfer it to them. Both registrars have to deal with the registrant at the time of transfer. What happens before that transfer or after that transfer is within the registrar's house. But what we're talking about here is the transfer between two registrars, not registrants.
Right.
So let's not confuse the issue.
Notice that the ETRP happens when you do it that way, but it doesn't go into effect under the transfer entirely at GoDaddy, for example. But then you get caught up by a new twist, which is what happens when you have a registrant change.
Okay,
George, what you just described is a completely
lock or whatever
internal transaction. It is not governed by ICANN policy at all.
Yes.
Okay, George, this working group is addressing IRTP. We are not addressing internal transfers or what we refer to as trades as it happens in CCTLDs.
No, it actually was one of the charter questions. When can registrars impose the lock?
All right.
Where's the charter questions? ST. If you look at the charter questions, it was one of them. You praised the GoDaddy method as a means a really bad policy.
I think George is referring to our second charter question, or possibly our third, which is that whether or not there should be considerations to a lock if there is a change of registrant in conjunction with a change of registrar. Right, and
right.
I think that what you're confusing us with here, George, is that you've kind of commingled a couple of topics really closely in a short period of time, and I think that you kind of lost your audience here. I mean, we weren't following that jump.
Right, it's charter question number C.
Okay, it's a bit hard to follow. Okay. Right then, does anybody else have any other questions or comments? Okay, we are opening the comment period for this initial report. Expect Marika around the July 5th. So, if you have any thoughts or any feedback you'd like to give us, please do so as soon as the comment period opens. Rob, as you've provided plenty of input today, I expect to see lots of input from you. But if anybody else has any input, or if anybody's interested in joining the working group who comes from a different view or whatever, they are more than welcome to join. Thank you all for coming to join us this afternoon. And if you just have a look at the slides there, you can see the basic information on where you can find out what we've been working on, and you can review what we've discussed to date. And thank you for your time. Session closed. And yes.
Operator, can you please stop the recording?